Hey, it's Rachel Cook, your modern mentor. I'm the founder of Lead Above Noise, a firm specializing in activating workplaces, helping leaders create the conditions that unleash bigger results while engaging our teams. If your team could use an activation boost, a pulse check, a talk, a workshop, don't be shy. Today's episode is an interview with Jacob Morgan about his latest book, Leading with Vulnerability. Jacob Morgan is a trained futurist and one of the world's leading authorities on leadership, the future of work, and the employee experience. Jacob's mission and passion is to create great leaders, engaged employees, and future-ready organizations. And everything he does is based on those three pillars. His work has been endorsed by Adam Grant, Seth Godin, Marshall Goldsmith, and more. Jacob is the best-selling author of 5 books. The latest, which we discussed in this interview, again, is Leading with Vulnerability. In this conversation, we get into why vulnerability is often misunderstood, why it can actually be a hindrance to great leadership, and actionable strategies you can use at any level to tap into your vulnerability superpowers. Jacob Morgan, welcome to the Modern Mentor Podcast. What a pleasure to have you here.
Thank you for having me.
I have really been looking forward to this conversation. I know you have authored a number of books. We can talk about anything you want to talk about today, but I do know that your most recent is called Leading with Vulnerability. And you have a bit of an interesting take and an interesting twist on that. So I've got some questions lined up, but I would love to hear a little bit about the backstory. So why this book and what is its kind of core message?
The core message of the book, a little bit counterintuitive to the title, is being vulnerable at work can hurt you far more than it can help you. And I'm sure we'll talk a little bit about more why that is and what you should be doing instead. But the book initiative came from two different angles. One was personal and one was on the business side. On the business side, when I wrote a previous book, which came out in 2020 called The Future Leader, I was interviewing 140 CEOs of companies around the world. And when I was interviewing a lot of these executives, the theme of vulnerability came up a lot. And I took a mental note of that because the conversations and the challenges that these CEOs were exploring around vulnerability, I thought were very interesting. On the one hand, a lot of these CEOs were telling me that their employees wanted them to be confident and visionary and competent and strong leaders. But then on the other hand, employees were also saying, well, we want you to talk about your challenges and your struggles and your failures and mistakes. And a lot of leaders were trying to figure out, well, what kind of a leader am I supposed to be? The one that talks about the mistakes or failures, or the one that talks about my vision and demonstrates competence and that I'm a, you know, visionary leader? And that was on the one side. On the other hand, a lot of these leaders were telling me that they acknowledged and understood why vulnerability was important in their personal lives, because it creates connections, it builds relationships with friends, family members. However, at work, you have a different dynamic. At work, you have leaders, you have customers, projects, deadlines, you're part of a team, you have a hierarchy, you're being paid a salary. So vulnerability at work is not the same as it is in your personal life. And furthermore, vulnerability for leaders is not the same as it is for non-leaders. And I thought these were very, very interesting questions to try to explore and understand, because vulnerability is a very powerful thing, but there is a wrong way and a right way to approach it. And I thought if we could figure out the right way to do it at work, then we would be able to unlock a lot of potential from our employees, be able to drive business performance and see a lot of really great impact. On the personal side, I always thought that vulnerability was, for lack of a better word, stupid. I grew up my parents are immigrant parents from the former Republic of Georgia. And I grew up with immigrant parents. And my mom always tried to model emotional vulnerability and openness with me. But my dad was the exact opposite. Now, as a young boy, I grew up watching my dad, who always told me, don't talk about your mistakes, never show any weakness, always try to be number one, don't show emotion. And that's how I grew up for pretty much my entire adult life. And even to this day, when I go visit my parents' house, the first thing my dad always says to me is, hey, how many push-ups can you do? How many pull-ups can you do? Let's, you know, come out in the backyard. Let's have a little fitness contest. And so I thought vulnerability was dumb, for lack of a better word, until a couple years ago when I had a series of panic attacks. And I couldn't figure out why I was having these panic attacks. And it turned out, after going to talk to some doctors and therapists, that I was having these panic attacks because I had committed to writing a book about vulnerability when I did not believe in vulnerability. And so I thought that was a very interesting sign, a very interesting moment that really taught me that, you know, there is something here. So I had the personal journey and the business journey.
Wow. And you talk a little bit about those panic attacks at the very beginning of the book, which, especially for somebody coming from the background that you just described, sounds very brave. I'm curious, can I ask, has your dad read the book?
You know, that's a good question. I mean, he knows about the panic attacks because when I had them and, you know, I would reach out to my parents and I would stay with them because I keep in mind that I did not know that these were panic attacks. This was happening during the heart of COVID. And there was a period for almost 2 weeks where I could not get in to go see a doctor because it was also during the holidays. And I would try to go to urgent care. And when I would go to urgent care, the people at the front desk would say, we're filled with COVID patients. And unless this is an emergency, we can't help you. And so I could not get in to see a doctor. So I had no idea what was happening with me. I legit thought that I was having a heart attack and that I was going to die. And so eventually when it became clear that I was having these panic attacks, I had no idea how to get rid of them. And they would just randomly start. Like I would be sitting eating a sandwich or I would just be hanging out with family. And for people not familiar with panic attacks, what happens is your heart starts beating really quickly. Like my resting heart rate is probably below 60 beats per minute. And when I would get these panic attacks, it would go up to 110, 120, 130 beats per minute, which is the equivalent of jogging and you're not moving. I would be overcome with fear and dread. And it's just a very, very terrible, terrible feeling. And so my dad's response was, oh, you got to kick panic attacks ass. Like you got to, you know, and I'm like, what are you talking about, man? And so his whole mentality was just like, tough it out. Like, you know, just knock it out. I'm like, oh my God. So I think he read the book. He reads a lot of my content. He's read all my books. He's of that mindset, right? The old school former USSR mindset where you can mentally just overcome anything. And if you tell yourself that you can beat it and conquer it and like this aggressive macho attitude that, you know, that's all you need. Fortunately, that approach didn't really work for me.
Right, right. Quick side note, I would love to get my dad and your dad on a podcast sometime. That would be a really compelling conversation.
Oh, he would say very inappropriate things. You don't want my dad anywhere near a podcast, near a microphone, near video, the things that this man would say.
Challenge accepted.
Yes.
So, you know, it's so interesting. And I want to get into this a little bit, even sort of your generational comment. You know, one of the things I've noticed, so a lot of the work that I do with organizations is around this concept that I call activation, which is really about helping organizations kind of tap into their full potential, creating conditions where people can work more effectively. And there are different triggers that cause people to call me. And one of the triggers, one of the things that I will have people reach out and say sometimes is something to the effect of, you know, it's always felt like a family around here, and we've kind of lost that family feeling. We have to solve that problem. And what I always tell organizations is, I understand what you're saying, and it sounds like we have some culture work to do, but I think the first problem we need to solve is this misunderstanding that work should feel like a family, because to your point, our personal lives and our work lives are not different. There should be safety. There should be connection. There should be certain elements of family. But at the end of the day, business is business. And that's what I really heard you saying at the very beginning there. So I think we are on the same page.
It's interesting because I'm working on the second edition of my book that came out in 2017 called The Employee Experience Advantage. Okay. And I'm interviewing over 100 CHROs at companies around the world. And this question of family comes up quite a bit. And I'm noticing that there are CHROs that stand on two different sides of this perspective. Actually, quite a few CHROs are telling me that they do want to view their team as a family. And these are big, large organizations. And I push back at them and I ask them the same thing. I say, well, how can you say that when the average tenure for most employees is 2, maybe 3 years? And their response is always, well, if we give employees the mobility, the growth, the advancement, if we take care of them, if they feel like they belong here, why would they ever want to leave? Right? I mean, if they have everything that they need at this organization, what would be the incentive for them to possibly leave and go elsewhere? And so that's the approach that some and not all CHROs are taking. Of course, there is the entire other camp that says, of course, our organizations are not a family. You don't fire your family. Your family doesn't leave after 2 to 3 years. So I think one is a little bit more aspirational, where we would love it if people stayed at this company and they never left. And we want to try to create that kind of an environment. But you know, then there's the other camp of, we get it. People are going to be here for maybe a few years. We want to get the most out of them. We want to contribute the most we can to them to help them become better people. And then hopefully keep that relationship when they transition. So it's really interesting to see the two different sides of the coin.
Absolutely. And we'll have to have you back on when that second edition comes out, because I'm all in. I'm intrigued. So I wanted to ask you, you know, going back to this point about our dads, and we're sort of joking, but there is something of a generational divide that's kind of shown itself. You know, while I was reading your book, one of the things that kept coming up for me, and I'm sure I'm not the first to mention this, but I couldn't stop thinking about Ted Lasso, right? I just feel like Ted Lasso has become such a cultural phenomenon over these past few years. And I was just thinking about how even just a few years prior to the launch of that show, I don't know that it could have come out, that it could have sort of had the life that it had. But I think a lot of people would argue, and I'm curious in your opinion, that Ted Lasso was sort of the embodiment of vulnerability, among other things, at work. And I'm curious kind of what your thought is on that, but also just more generally, what do you think has happened in the past however many years that has sort of created a space for a conversation about vulnerability in the workplace, whether you're in favor of it or not?
I think the pandemic was a huge thing. I think the past, you know, from 2020 to 2022, 2023, I mean, even currently, right, you can still be argued, has done more for the topic of emotional intelligence and vulnerability than anything that we've seen. And it's precisely because we saw into each other's homes. Whether purposefully or inadvertently, we were welcomed into each other's homes. We saw how we lived. We saw family members. We were asking how we were doing. It was a very scary time, right? Some people lost loved ones. It was a pretty tough time for a lot of people. And so I think that fueled a lot of the discussion and conversation around vulnerability. And I think where we are today is we've over-indexed on vulnerability. And so before people get really mad at me and start sending you angry comments, I should distinguish between this concept of vulnerability versus what it means to lead with vulnerability. And I think from a high level, you can think of vulnerability as basically doing or saying something that exposes you to the potential of emotional harm at work. Right. So talking about a mistake, admitting to a failure, saying that you're having a tough time, it's anything that makes you feel vulnerable. And it's also information that somebody else can then take if they wanted to and use it as a way to harm you. And I have several stories in the book of where that happens. So vulnerability, a simple example might be your boss gives you a project, you mess up on that project, and now you have to tell your boss that you messed up. So being vulnerable would be going to your leader at the time and saying, hey, I'm so sorry. I know this was important. I messed it up. And I don't know what else to say. I'm just really sorry I did that. Now, on the surface, it doesn't sound like a terrible thing, right? First of all, it's great that you have that psychological safety to be able to come forward and talk about that mistake. But again, personal and work, different dynamic. So we need to remember the work dynamic. You still have customers. You still have deadlines. You still have projects. You have a team. You have all these other things. So you apologize for screwing something up, but what's happening on the work dynamic? Customer still not happy. Deadline still not met. Team still not happy that you messed this up. Problem still not solved. And so when you come forward and talk about a mistake, your leader's not going to look at you and say, oh, thank you so much for telling me about this mistake. Your leader is going to look at you and they're going to say, okay, great. Well, thank you for telling me. What are you going to do about it? The vulnerability is about exposing these gaps that you have. Leading with vulnerability is about exposing the gaps that you have, but then demonstrating what you're trying to do to close those gaps. It's bringing together connection, which is vulnerability, with competence, which is leadership. So going back to that example, you might say, I'm really sorry. I know I messed this project up. But here's what I learned from the mistake that I made. And here are three things that I'm going to do to make sure that that mistake never happens again. We have over-indexed so much on the vulnerability side that we have forgotten about the competence side. And I think in a lot of organizations, we use vulnerability as a way to justify poor performance. And so what I'm telling organizations and what I'm telling leaders is not that vulnerability is bad, but you have to bring in the competence piece. You have to bring in the leadership piece because ultimately you have that work dynamic. Whether you're a first-time leader, whether you made a mistake on a project, whether you're going through a tough time, whether you don't know how to do something. It's not to say that you can't ask for help, but also try to demonstrate how you're trying to solve your problem, how you're trying to get better. Hey, I don't really know how to do this. I came up with a couple ideas. I would love it if you can take a look at it and give me feedback. That's vulnerability and also trying to demonstrate I'm trying to close the gap, as opposed to, hey, I need help with this. Can you do this for me? Big difference. And so in the context of work, the two most important aspects for any leader are connection and competence. If you only connect with your people and you don't demonstrate the competence, then people will say they have a great relationship with you, but you shouldn't be in a leadership role because you haven't demonstrated that you're actually good at your job. Similarly, if you only focus on competence, people might say, wow, you are so great at your job, but I don't feel engaged or motivated or inspired working with and for you because we don't have that connection. So ideally, you want to have both of those things. Demonstrate that you are competent and be able to connect with people. And I think too much, especially now, we're only focusing on the connection and we're forgetting about bringing in that competence piece. And that's what I'm hoping we're going to do a much better job of going forward.
Nice. Okay. That absolutely resonates for me. And so I'm curious, I would love to bring it back. So at the very beginning, you were talking about some of the conversations you were having with leaders who were struggling with this dichotomy of, I'm supposed to be visionary, I'm supposed to be expressing ideas and goals, but I'm also supposed to show a softer side and share my feelings. And so how would you take this connection and competence framework and maybe help a leader who comes to you with that kind of dilemma? So for example, if a leader, let's say, has to lead their team through a big upcoming change, and they are struggling with how much do I kind of declare a bold vision and lay out a really robust plan and demonstrate confidence that I know the way versus express anxiety or uncertainty or ask questions, how would you sort of coach someone on that?
There are actually two stories that I have in the book, which are somewhat opposites, which kind of illustrate that point. One of them is from Hollis Harris. He's the former CEO of Continental Airlines. And anybody that knows the history of Continental Airlines knows in the late 80s, early 90s, the airline was going through a very tough time. Eventually, it got absorbed and acquired by United Airlines. But there was a period, I think it was in August of 1993, where the board of Continental Airlines told Hollis that he needs to send out a memo to his workforce to talk about what's going on in the business and the economy. And so he sends out a memo to his entire workforce. And I think at the time it was around mid-30 or maybe low 40,000 employees. And he sends out his memo and he's talking about the challenges and the problems and that the company is at war within itself and with macroeconomic factors. And he basically lays everything out. And then at the end of this memo that he sends out, he tells employees that the best thing that they could do is to pray for the future of the company. That's a very, very vulnerable memo to send out to your workforce, right? I mean, you're the CEO of the company, and you're basically saying like, everything's going to hell. Now, the very next day he was fired. I didn't interview Hollis Harris. He passed away, but I did interview another CEO named Fleetwood Grobler. And he's the CEO of a South African energy company called Sasol. And when he took over as CEO, the company was $13 billion in debt. The banks were about to come in and repossess the business. They also had around 30,000 employees. And he too was asked to give a town hall to his entire workforce and have some kind of a message as the new CEO. And he started off his message very similarly to the way that Hollis Harris did. He talked about the challenges that the business was faced, the microeconomic and macroeconomic factors, what was going on internally with the business, what was going on externally. He also said that, you know, I don't know exactly how we're going to get out of this. But he said, I have a vision for where this business can go. I know that we're able to rebuild trust in the eyes of our customers and in the eyes of our employees. And if you come with me on this journey, and if we put trust in each other, I know we're going to be able to turn things around to create a successful business. And of course, the memo was a little bit longer than that, where he outlined some things in there. But the point is that he not only demonstrated the vulnerability piece at the beginning, but he demonstrated the leadership piece, how he's trying to close the gap. So he acknowledged the problems that the company's going through a tough time. He acknowledged that he didn't have all the answers, but he also brought in that leadership piece of here's how we're going to move forward. Here's how we're going to figure things out. Here's what we're going to try to do to turn things around. That's a very different type of message to have, and the company's now doing quite well. So context also matters. And I have a framework in the book called the Vulnerability Wheel, which walks you through when you should be vulnerable and when you should not. Because there are certain times when it doesn't make sense. So Doug Parker, he's another CEO that I interviewed from American Airlines. And during the pandemic, anytime you would turn on any news station, they would basically be talking about how American Airlines was going bankrupt, the company was going to disappear. And Doug Parker had a choice, right? He could show up to work and acknowledge that and say, yeah, you're right. You know, they're talking about the end of this company. And yeah, I see it too. I don't know, guys, it's pretty tough. But what he told me instead is that he would sit in his car every morning before showing up to work. And for a few minutes every morning, he would sit in his car and basically pump himself up, get himself excited and motivated and optimistic about the business and the future of the company before he would show up to work. Because he knew that he could not step foot into his headquarters acknowledging and believing and talking about all the negativity and all the pessimism and how the company is going to disappear. Because if he did that, then it would be a self-fulfilling prophecy. If the CEO shows up to work and says, yeah, we are going to go bankrupt, your company will go bankrupt. And so he knew and acknowledged in that time that there were certain elements that he could not be vulnerable about, even though deep down inside, he did have a part of him that was not sure about what the future of the business was going to come, was going to be. So context matters in terms of what you share and what you don't.
Those are great. Those are great stories and they're great examples. And they really do help illustrate the importance of, you know, what I'm taking away from all of these examples is that honesty matters. So if your company is at risk, getting up on a stage and assuring everybody that there is absolutely no risk, nothing to be concerned about, and just being completely disingenuous, I don't think that is what you're recommending, but it is a blend of some level of truth and acceptance and acknowledgement, but also holding some accountability for driving the solution and sort of sitting in that driver's seat.
Yeah, that's very much the case. I mean, honesty, you mentioned authenticity there, which I think is a very interesting point as well, because one of the CEOs that I interviewed told me that early on in his career, he worked for a CEO who was a very tough, hard-nosed boss, right? The kind of like a Jack Welch personality, somebody who had no problem cursing at you, kicking in your teeth, right? Kind of old school 80s leader. And so he shows up to work one day, this guy who's working for this kind of a boss. And the CEO at the time brings everybody into a conference room, this really like tough CEO. And he brings everybody into a conference room and he starts playing The Wind Beneath My Wings by Bette Midler. And he starts telling all his top executives in the room that you are the wind beneath my wings, that I cannot do this without you, that you are so important to me, that everything I have is because of you. And these executives are looking at each other and they're thinking, what the hell's going on here? Like, did this guy just have a stroke? Because he was trying to show connection and vulnerability, but it came off in the most inauthentic way. That after that meeting, this guy that I talked to, with this current CEO that I interviewed, said that we preferred the hard-nosed boss because at least with him, we knew what we were getting. And all of a sudden, we show up to work one day and you're playing a Bette Midler song for us? Like, what? Who are you? So authenticity does play an important role when we think about this concept of leading with vulnerability. You can't just show up tomorrow and be this completely different person. That's not how it works. Because we have very good internal BS sensors where we know whether something is coming across as authentic or whether it's not. And speaking of authenticity, I thought that was just a funny story.
That is amazing. God, I wish I had been in that room. I'm sorry I missed that.
Yeah, that would be quite an experience.
So how do you feel like, you know, I know that you have a focus, keep me honest here, on the future of work. That's something you've talked a lot about. You focus on employee experience. I think you work with organizations on culture. How do you feel like the current state of work? And I know it still feels very unsettled and nobody quite knows where we're going to land. But for a lot of organizations, we're still working in very hybrid ways. A lot of people are now parts of teams where they've never actually met their colleagues in person. How are some of these factors, these realities of the current state of work, impacting our ability to make those connections that kind of make it safe to be vulnerable?
I don't think there's a substitute for in-person work. Now, again, I'm a big believer in flexible and hybrid work. Don't get me wrong. But I don't believe that there are certain aspects of in-person work, which can be replicated in a virtual environment. Similarly, and I think there's a difference between productivity versus innovation. So I'll tell you what I mean, or productivity versus impact. I give a lot of keynote speeches to organizations around the world each year. Can I be more productive doing virtual talks? So how many virtual talks can I give in a day sitting here staring into a camera? 4, 5, maybe 6? I can be super productive giving a ton of keynotes. Where am I going to have the greatest impact? Is it going to be where I am staring into a camera lens and when people are looking at me on a screen and they only see me from here up? Or is it going to be where I'm on a stage, where I can look people in the eye, where I can see their body language, where people can see me, where I can gesticulate, where I can meet with people afterwards, where I can talk to people before I get on stage and you know, build some relationships? Where is the greater impact going to be? It's of course going to be via an in-person keynote. But can I be productive virtually? Of course. And the same thing is true when we think about hybrid or in-person work versus virtual work. And there have been several CEOs that have come forward. One is the CEO of Elevest. One is the CEO of Microsoft. I think several others have also acknowledged that, sure, if you want to just be productive, you don't need to come into the office. You can technically work anywhere you want. But productivity just means that you're going to go out of business later. Companies are not just interested in productivity. Companies are not just interested in knowing that you're getting the things done that you need to get done on a day-to-day. Companies are thinking about the future. And the future means innovation. The future means growth. The future means customer and employee relationships. A lot of the leadership development, a lot of those things are done far more effectively in person than they are in a virtual environment. Think about if you are an aspiring leader in a team and you want to become a future leader inside your organizations. How are you going to be more effective in developing who you are as a leader? Is it going to be taking some courses online? Is it going to be having a couple meetings with your leader virtually? Or is it going to be showing up to the office, doing in-person training, watching and observing your leader in different situations and circumstances, seeing how he or she negotiates and deals with tough situations, getting coffee with them and being able to have casual conversations? Where are you going to be a more effective leader? Seeing how they work on their physical presence, looking at how they deal with emotional intelligence, just seeing their overall persona in different environments. Are you going to be a better leader if you show up to the office or if you are standing behind a screen? I don't think anybody can argue that, of course, you will be far more effective in your leadership training and development if you spend time in the office getting that training versus staring at a screen. Same thing for building any kind of relationships. And I don't think anybody would argue that grabbing a cup of coffee with somebody in person is going to be just as effective as, hey, let's hop on a Zoom for 30 minutes. It's not the same. And again, I do believe in flexible and hybrid work, but there are certain things that I think you can do in an office that are better suited for that. And other things where if you're just doing calls, you're working on presentations, you're just doing kind of the day-to-day stuff, yeah, maybe you don't need to show up to work every day. But I do believe there is still very much a need and a function for in-person work. I also think, and one of the things that we don't talk about, is it depends on your goals and aspirations. I think now is a very unique time for people who have big dreams and big visions and goals and aspirations of getting into mid and senior and executive leadership roles. If that's you, you have a tremendous opportunity right now. Why? Because a lot of people are not wanting to show up to work. A lot of people are not wanting to put on the nice outfit, to commute, to pay for their transportation, to pay for lunch. A lot of people are not wanting to do that. If you're willing to make that sacrifice, and if you are willing to do those things and spend time in the office with your leaders so that they see you, so that you see them, so that you can have that more one-on-one time with your leaders, you're going to be positioned in a very, very unique way. So if you have those aspirations of leadership, I would encourage you now, when a lot of people don't want to show up to the office, you show up to the office because you're going to get that visibility. You're going to get that time from your leaders that is usually so hard to get. You're going to be seen and you will be spending more time with your leaders. However, if you don't have those aspirations, you're content with where you are. You don't want to get into leadership. You just want to make a paycheck and coast and chill and hang out. Hey, don't show up to the office. That's fine. But then don't get upset if a couple years later, you're not the one getting promoted, whereas your coworker is, who is making those sacrifices and is showing up to the office and is spending time with his or her leaders when you're not.
I think that's a really reasonable call to action. I think these past few years have gotten complicated. But I think at the end of the day, whether or not we feel like we can measure it quantitatively, there is something intangible about that in-person experience that just is not replicatable online. I think we've all felt it. So I think that's fair.
Yeah. And look, it is sacrifice, right? I mean, I can't tell you, I have around 1,000 episodes on my podcast. A lot of them have been with CEOs. And when you want to get into a senior and an executive leadership role, you make sacrifices that you don't even think that you have to make now. So everybody needs to decide for themselves, what are the sacrifices that I'm willing to make, right? If you're not willing to make those sacrifices, that's fine. But every executive that I've talked to and interviewed says, yeah, I had to move 4 or 5 times. One CEO, I recently talked to Randy Parker, the CEO of a motor company. I believe it was, let me see, I want to get it right. I think it was Hyundai Motor America. And so I interviewed him and he said, yeah, there was a period of time where I had to live in a separate house from my family because we were going through this crazy change in the business and I was working nonstop. I actually had to live separately, right? But again, he made these tremendous sacrifices. He had to live in different parts of the world. He had to work for very difficult leaders and managers. There were times where he had to have meetings at 4 or 5 in the morning. And then at the same time, he had to have meetings at 9 or 10 o'clock at night because he worked with an international business. He was willing to make those sacrifices to do what he needed to do to get into that CEO role. That's not for everybody. So everybody watching and listening needs to decide, what do you want out of your professional life? Where do you want to go? And if you're willing to make those sacrifices, I think you're going to be able to go a lot farther than your peers who won't.
There's one more concept in your book that I wanted to ask you about, and then I have just a couple concluding questions for you. There is a piece where you talk about what you call critical moments. In the context of vulnerability, you talk about a few different outcomes. And I really liked that framework. And I wondered if you could talk a little bit about that for the audience.
Sure. The whole premise of this is that vulnerability will be used against you. It's a near certainty. Just like at some point in your life, you'll ask somebody out on a date and they'll tell you no. At some point, you're going to ask for a raise, you'll be turned no. You'll be told no. At some point, you're going to ask for more money. You're going to ask for a promotion. You're going to ask for whatever it is. You will be told no. The same thing is true when we think about work. At some point, you will say or do something. You will be vulnerable and it will be used against you. It's not going to happen nearly as often as you think, but it will happen. And so when it does happen, you basically have a choice of things that you can do. And so when I was interviewing 100 CEOs for this new book, I was asking all these CEOs, how does vulnerability make you feel? Like leading up to a moment of vulnerability or being vulnerable, how does it make you feel? And every single one of them said that there's negative physiological reactions. So physical reactions and emotional reactions that they go through. Whether it is, you know, your palms are getting sweaty, your heart is beating, your stomach hurts. One CEO said that his lip and his voice starts to quiver because he's so nervous. It makes you uncomfortable. Nobody ever says vulnerability feels great. It's amazing. And so the idea of critical moments is kind of like in a game of chess. There's these ideas of critical moments where you kind of take a step back and you realize that you're at a moment in the game where the next thing that you do can either make you win the game or lose the game. You don't know exactly what it is, but you can just sense that it's a position on the board that's complicated and you really need to be careful with the next thing that you do. So a critical moment is very similar. It's this idea of, you know, that you're approaching this moment of vulnerability or you're feeling vulnerable. You have all these negative feelings. And so you have this critical moment of 3 different things that you can do called breakthrough moments, learning moments, and fixed moments. And just from a high level, and you know, people read the book, it goes into more detail. A breakthrough moment is basically, it occurs when negative emotions or feelings quickly turn into positive ones. So for example, let's say I need to come to you. I need to talk to you about a mistake or something like that. And I'm feeling very uncomfortable. My heart's beating. I just feel very stressed out. I come to you with something and you're like, hey, it's all good. Don't worry about it. Don't stress. Everything's fine. Now, all of a sudden, my negative feelings and emotions very quickly turn positive. So you have the person receiving vulnerability has a lot of power in terms of helping somebody get through that breakthrough moment, which is the period at which those negative feelings and emotions turn positive. Maybe you are on stage, and this is a story that one CEO shared with me. He was on stage giving a talk in front of thousands of people, and some of his mentors, titans of industry, were sitting in the front row. And this guy was freaking out, and he was nervous, and he was just a mess. And so he gets to the front of the stage, he starts giving his talk, and he looks at the front row, and he sees that one of his mentors is like nodding. He's like, yeah, you got this. And all of a sudden, he got through this breakthrough moment where those negative feelings turned positive because he felt supported, he felt seen, he felt like somebody had his back. So breakthrough moments are those moments where those negative feelings and emotions can turn positive. Then we have what I call fixed moments. Fixed moments are not usually places you want to be. These are dangerous moments. A fixed moment happens when you are vulnerable, it's used against you, and mentally you say, I knew I should not have done that. I'm never going to do it again. In other words, it locks you into this negative perspective of never being vulnerable again. Because I did something, it didn't go well. That's why I should never do it again. And we have to remember that without vulnerability, there is no learning and growth and development. Because vulnerability is essentially about acknowledging a gap that you have. If you don't acknowledge any gaps that you have, you're basically saying, I'm perfect. I don't need to learn. I don't need to grow. I don't need to get better. I don't have any problems. That's nobody, right? Nobody falls into that camp. And the leadership piece is what actually gets you to take action on those gaps. So without this concept of leading with vulnerability, you can improve. And so when you lock yourself into that fixed mindset, you really hurt your career, you hurt your potential, you hurt your ability to become a better version of yourself, both professionally and personally. So if you have aspirations of leadership and you say, I'm never going to be vulnerable, it's not going to work. The third type of moment is a learning moment. A learning moment is when you take that approach, something doesn't go well, and instead of having it be a fixed moment, you turn it into a learning moment. And you say, well, all right, what did I learn about myself in this situation? What did I learn about the other person? What did I learn about this situation? And how can I take the things that I've learned and apply it so that when I am vulnerable in the future, I can increase my chances of having a more positive outcome? And that's the ideal thing that you want, right? You want those learning moments. And so those are kind of the three options that we have. Breakthrough moments, we have fixed moments, and then we have learning moments. And I think that is an important way for people to think about it, because when something doesn't go their way, they can just mentally say, okay, I don't want to have a fixed moment because that's going to hurt me. How do I turn this into a learning moment? How do I make this into something that I can learn from and get better from and grow from? And that's a very conscious thing that you have to do.
And if you do it soon enough, if you do that sort of intentional learning soon enough after the incident, do you still have an opportunity to change the outcome?
Yes, you do. But you also have the opportunity to create something even better. So one of the CEOs that I interviewed, she asked to remain anonymous after she shared this story with me. But she wasn't the CEO of a company, but she was like second or third in command for a big European company. And she was very vulnerable with her CEO at the time, who was also a woman. And she told her CEO that, you know, she never went to college. She didn't go through kind of the traditional educational institution. She wasn't even a traditional employee at the company. She was kind of hired as an outsider. She talked about her father who passed away. She shared a lot of things with this CEO. Oh, and she also shared that she struggled with confidence, and that she was trying to work on those things. And this CEO at the organization decided to use all these things against her. And so this lady goes on vacation one day, and she comes back from her vacation with her family. And she notices that all of a sudden her office gets moved two or three doors down from the CEO. So she used to be right next door to the CEO. Now her office is three doors down. She notices that employees on her team are being poached and moved into other areas of the business without her knowledge. She's starting to get ridiculed in meetings. She is assigned an executive coach. And she confides in this executive coach only to find that the executive coach is reporting everything that she's saying to the CEO who hired this executive coach for her. Finally, the CEO says, you know what? We have to put you on a performance improvement plan. And this lady at the time said, you know what? I'm out of here. I'm done. And I asked her after she left, I said, well, are you ever going to be vulnerable with anyone else ever again? And she said, absolutely, I will. I learned a lot from that situation. And now she's the CEO of a big telecommunications company in Europe. So in that situation, she turned things around by taking what she learned, and she knew, she understood. She said, going forward, I need to do a much better job of making sure that who I am as a person aligns to the values of the business, and that the people I hire, you know, I make sure I'm surrounding myself by people who have my best interest in heart. So she learned a lot from that situation, took everything that she learned to become the CEO of a much larger, more successful organization. So absolutely, you can take the things that you learn, you can turn things around internally inside of an organization, or you can take the things that you learn and use it as a way to make yourself even more successful, maybe even if it's with another organization.
So I want to be respectful of your time, Jacob. I feel like we have covered a lot of ground. I feel like there were some really amazing, I mean, you have so many stories of CEOs and executives at various companies, various industries that you've interviewed. There's so much richness in the book. Is there anything really critical you feel like I haven't asked you about that just feels really important to get out there before we close?
I mean, there are a lot of things, but we probably don't have time to get into all of them. So there are a couple of frameworks and concepts I have in the book. I have these five different types of vulnerable leader superheroes. I have eight attributes of vulnerable leaders, which are very important. So there are different, and you know, there's the vulnerability wheel, which is a framework that walks you through how to do these things. But I think from a high level, the most important message that I have for people is that whenever vulnerability is present, ask yourself how you can add a little bit of leadership to the equation. How can you add a little bit of that competence to the equation? And similarly, vice versa can also be true. When you have a strong sense of that leadership and competence, ask yourself, how can I add a little bit of connection to the equation? So the whole idea, and I should have done this earlier, a vulnerable leader is a leader who intentionally opens themselves up to the potential of emotional harm while taking action to create a positive outcome. So I want people to remember, you can open yourself up to the potential of emotional harm, but also try to take action to create that positive outcome. The vulnerable leader equation is leadership plus vulnerability equals leading with vulnerability. So if that's the one thing that people remember from anything that we've talked about today, I'll be happy.
I love it. And just to clarify for anyone listening, leadership in this case, keep me honest, does not necessarily mean you are a leader of people, right? It is for anybody, individual contributor or otherwise. It's about demonstrating a sense of leadership and a sense of accountability in connection with that connection.
Yes. Anybody, current or aspiring leader. But yeah, this is something that's relevant for anybody who's looking to be successful in their career, to potentially move up, to make a greater impact, to influence others, to unlock the potential of others, and to be more successful in whatever it is that they do.
Well, Jacob, thank you again so much for joining me today. We learned a ton. As you pointed out, there is so much more richness in the book, lots of frameworks, super instructive. I hope people will go grab a copy.
Yeah. Can I, we put up a special URL. Is it okay if I share it?
Oh, please do.
Okay. So it's one thing to like tell people, you know, go to Amazon and type it in, but we put together a URL to make it easier for people. So if you just go to leadwithvulnerability.com, it'll take you to different places where you can buy it. And then I always like to give people my email address if they have any questions, because this is a pretty big topic. So if anybody has any questions about this, they can reach out to me directly, jacob@thefutureorganization.com. So obviously my website is thefutureorganization.com, and I'm happy to answer any questions.
Amazing. Thank you so much. It's been a pleasure.
Thank you for having me.
I hope you enjoyed my conversation with Jacob Morgan. Grab a copy of his book, Leading with Vulnerability, wherever books are sold. And check out his podcast, Great Leadership, where Jacob interviews CEOs, best-selling authors, and thought leaders who offer access to their greatest leadership insights and tips. Join me next week for another great episode. Until then, visit my website at leadabovenoise.com if your workplace could use an activation boost, a talk, a workshop, a pulse check, you choose. You can follow Modern Mentor on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or wherever you listen to podcasts. Find and follow me on LinkedIn. Thanks so much for listening and have a successful week. Modern Mentor is a quick and dirty tips podcast. It's audio engineered by Dan Firebend. Our director of podcasts is Brandon Getches. Our podcast and advertising operations specialist is Morgan Christensen. Our digital operations specialist is Holly Hutchings. Our marketing and publicity assistant is Davina Tomlin. And Cameron Lacey is our marketing contractor.